Besides the illustrious Senator Starr, who's going to testify, we are unfortunately blessed with the Senate President as well, so we should probably welcome them both up first. And we do expect a quorum in this committee, Mr. President.
We do have a quorum.
We want you on your best behavior, please. Senator Starr, if you can, just would you like the gavel?
Sure.
Okay. Please proceed.
I would like you to go first. No, you go first. You're in a committee. You go first.
Oh, excuse me. We will have the committee administrator read the bill first. Please tell me what this bill does and doesn't do, please.
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, Senate Bill 8 directs Department of State Police to work with law enforcement agencies, Department of Transportation, and media to implement State Amber Plan.
You know, there's a lot more important people in here, actually some state employees and stuff that we should probably have here, up here first to not interrupt their day. But since you're up here, Senator Courtney, why don't you go ahead?
I'd like to defer to a member of the committee who has requested he be allowed to speak first, Senator Bruce Starr.
Okay. Senator Starr, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, President Courtney. This is an important issue. It was brought to my attention after the situation in the state of California, where the Amber Alert went statewide there, and they readily captured the gentleman who had picked up the two girls. And I thought, my goodness, what a great system. We ought to have this system in Oregon. And I got on the phone real quick and started making phone calls, and I found out that the Washington County Consolidated Communications Agency, Washington County 911, had begun the process of implementing it in Washington County, the Amber Alert, which I thought was great, but I thought that it needed to be implemented statewide, and so I began work in that direction, and it wasn't too long before I learned that Senator Courtney as well was working on a similar idea, and then the governor picked up the effort with his executive order. The Amber Alert system has proven itself across the nation as a vital means of recovering and protecting the most innocent among us. Amber Alert offers the public a powerful tool to wield against those who prey on the youngest members of our society. With this power comes the obligation to guarantee the best possible criteria for initiating the Amber Alert system. This criteria can best be established by those who deal with these situations every day, which is the state police in partnership with the various partners at the local level and across the state. Senate Bill 8 gives the OSP the task of developing this plan of action. With this plan, the Amber Alert will become an effective means to bring loved ones home and criminals to justice. The Amber Alert system in Oregon can only be effective with strict guidelines, strict policies, and practical applications. These three steps, combined with the expertise of the OSP, can ensure the best information to the public as well as the most effective use of the Amber Alert system. In a society that's bogged down by alarms, cautions, warnings, are we on yellow or blue or green or whatnot? They hear this every day. It's important for us to mandate and to ensure that the public, that every alert delivered to them through the Amber Alert system is carefully scrutinized and deserves their time and attention. One of the issues that is of great interest for me is for us to partner with the private sector, folks that are on the roads in the private sector every day, and the group that comes to mind most readily is the trucking industry and their ability to be eyes and ears out on the roads. And that was one of the issues that I brought, I guess, to the attention of the various public agencies that are involved, to see if there's a way to coordinate that with the private sector, again, to have more and more folks with their eyes and ears out there watching in the case of an Amber Alert. I've talked to the members of the industry, and they're already involved in Homeland Security issues and plugged in with that whole effort, and so this is an opportunity for them to build on the training that they already had. And so I'm excited about not only the work that's being done on the public side, but also the opportunity to kind of broaden and allow for kind of a wider scope by including the private sector as well. That concludes my testimony. I'd urge the committee to adopt the bill and move the bill.
Well, thank you, Senator Starr. I think you've actually used up all the senatorial time, and we really thank you folks for showing up. And any questions of Senator Starr? Seeing none, we'll... Oh, Senator Courtney, I'm sorry. Did you want to say something, sir?
Yes, Chair Corcoran and members of the Senate General Government Committee, Senator Walker, Senator Minnis, Senator Starr, and as I've already acknowledged, Senator Corcoran and your administrator, Mr. Ellsworth. I first of all want to acknowledge...
would you like to say hi to Ms. Gravel, to our staff as well?
Ms. Gravel and members of the audience. And
you don't have to play up to the audience, Senator. Just
I want
to the bill.
First of all, congratulate Senator Bruce Starr. At the time, he was Representative Bruce Starr when he was working very hard on Amber Alert. Also, at the time, he was former Representative Floyd Buzanski. Now, Representative Floyd Buzanski was also working very hard on this in a capacity down in Eugene. I believe Senator John Minnis has also been a big player in this. So all these players were involved long before I got involved. And as I understand, the Amber Alert, as we know it, was named after a 9-year-old Amber Hagerman, and she was from Dallas, Texas, and who was kidnapped and brutally murdered, and I believe that was back in 1996. This program, and I saw a color-coded map of our country yesterday, and I do not have it with me. I think it exists in some 24 other states, but how it exists depends upon law or administrative rule. It also exists in a number of communities within states, so it's fluid in terms of where it exists, not only statewide, but locally as well. It's interesting. I didn't know until yesterday. I looked at my file on it. That Amber Alert stands for America's Missing Broadcast Emergency Response. And simply how it works, as I understand it, and I would defer to Senator Minnis on this, if a child is abducted and it is in danger of serious bodily injury or death, law enforcement and agencies can activate Amber. Once the amber light is on, information about the abductor and the victim is sent out on radio, TV, reader boards, and two-way radios. Now, those are my own words, Chair Corcoran. That's my own interpretation of what happens. It's not highly technical what I've just said to you. But as a layperson, it's my understanding that's how it works. Time is critical because having served on the Judiciary Committee all my life, with the exception of this session, which you denied me that right to do and broke my heart, I have learned from experience that...
You've given a very good explanation so far, Senator, given the fact that you have limitations such as being Irish.
What I've learned, if I may be allowed to proceed, please. Is there a vice chair of this committee? Yes, Senator Minnis, would you please work with me on this? What I've learned from being on the Judiciary Committee for many years, in which he chaired it, is time is critical, because once a child is taken, if they're harmed, it usually happens within the first few hours of abduction. Now, this is tough stuff to talk about, but that's what I understand in talking to law enforcement people. We don't have much time. We got to go, and we got to go quickly. Now, I need to tell you, and I think we've handed out, my staff has handed out a number of documents to you. The former Governor John Kitzhaber said we should do this through executive order, I believe back on October of 2002.
October 28th.
You're using a newspaper article. I believe I had. What did you say? Excuse me, Chair Corcoran. Can I, Senator
Walker? Did you have comment?
Yes, tonight? Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Yes.
It was October 28th of 2000.
Thank you. So
you are correct.
I was. Proceed, Senator.
Thank you very much, Senator Corcoran, Chair Corcoran. I've been thrown off here. What happened is it directed that the plan involved a voluntary partnership with the state police, emergency medical management, Oregon Department of Transportation, our broadcasters, our chiefs of police, sheriffs, and other emergency types of people. There is, however, no law on the book as of today. The legislature has not spoken on this issue. This law, if you decide to pass this, would require the Director of State Police develop an Amber Alert program. By passing such legislation, the legislature makes an absolute statement about the protection of our children. It is also an absolute statement that this legislature wishes to continue the previous executive order. Amber Alert is about sadness. It's about the kidnapping of children. It's also about recovering a kidnapped child before he or she is hurt or killed. Amber Alert instantly puts eyes and ears everywhere. Those eyes and ears may be the only chance, only hope for a child's safe return. I just want to conclude with that because Senator Starr has spoken very well on that. The one group of individuals that came up in my discussions on this were the truckers, because I was thinking about state police and all those types, and then we realized the importance of truckers and who pick up on this, and they often could be a key player in coming up with information where we could find the individual who's kidnapped a child and as a result return the child safely. With that, Mr. Corcoran, the chair of this committee, I will take any questions, comments, or criticisms you may have.
The criticisms we don't have time for. Are there any questions of the witnesses?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Menace?
One question is there a need to maintain some flexibility in the statute with respect to transitions or changes in the program? As I understand it, we have it, a program via executive order now. If we put this in statute and adopt rules, does that make it too rigid to change in the event that it's necessary to change it?
Chair Corcoran, Senator Menace, yes, you should, because what I learned here is the local law enforcement people have to make a decision when a report comes in, Senator Menace, whether they try to activate this or not. That's a judgment call, and this is what complicates it. So I think you do have to allow as much flexibility as possible with those kinds of individuals, not only in terms of where the plan is today. And to be frank with you, Senator Menace, I don't know where the plan is today. I don't know how much the executive order is implemented. For all I know, it's been fully implemented. I don't know that, but I do think you have to allow for what Senator Minister says, flexibility on the part of the emergency services people and the law enforcement community.
Actually, Senator Minister, Greg Williford was in my office, and I see he's here to testify, and he, and I think they're neutral on the bill, but he has some very good insight into what kind of adjustments might be have to be made in terms of the rulemaking, because I guess there's some ongoing federal rulemaking going on right now. So he'll speak to that as well.
All right, great. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, members of the Senate General Government Committee. It's the first committee I've appeared before this session.
Senator Courtney, while you're here, maybe you could answer a question on another bill that we're going to have coming up on the DPSST. Is it true that with the current budget cuts, that's going to go down to just the DT?
The DT. Chair Corcoran,
I thought you could be helpful, but apparently you can't. So let's get some witnesses up here that we need for this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Do you plan on coming back here very often?
I think when I look to sign bills in the future, if they're mine, they're not going here.
Okay, thank you very much. Because you know it'll happen when they do come here. So could we have Greg Wilford up, please?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
Welcome.
Members of the committee, my name is Greg Williford. I am the commander of the Department of State Police Bureau of Investigation. And I'm prepared to, I've got some detailed testimony that you have with some attachments on Oregon's statewide Amber Alert plan and system. What I am prepared to do is probably just an overview of the state system and a little bit about the genesis of where we have come from in developing the system and plan last fall. Part of my duties as Bureau Commander with the State Police is I also serve as the chair of the State Amber Alert Review Committee, and that's in place today. And prior to that time, I last fall served as the chair of the State Amber Alert Planning Group, which was the group tasked by the Governor's Public Safety Policy and Planning Council to develop a statewide Amber Alert plan and system for the state of Oregon. Senator Courtney's description of why Amber system is important in a verified child abduction is correct, in that the time is of the essence after a confirmed child abduction and the safe recovery of that child. It's a matter of hours. And the first few hours are critical in getting information out to people that could assist in recovery of that child. And that's what the Amber Plan really stands to do. It was created in 1996 as really a legacy toward the violent kidnap and murder of a child in Arlington, Texas that was 9 years old, and they developed a plan to, based on the tragedy that occurred there, to really galvanize and get the enlisted help of the public in a confirmed child abduction. The Amber Plan is a voluntary partnership between law enforcement and the broadcast industry to activate essentially an all-points bulletin using the emergency alert system as one of the primary mechanisms to get information out to the public regarding a confirmed child abduction. That is the old emergency broadcast system, the EAS system that we have in place today to do that. The goal, again, of course, is to instantly galvanize an entire community to get hundreds, if not thousands, of people out there looking for the suspect and or child in the abduction. This past fall, in September of 2002, the State Amber Alert Planning Group was formed with the oversight of the Governor's Public Safety Policy and Planning Council. The planning group was tasked with the development of the statewide Amber Alert system for use by Oregon public safety agencies. The planning group had representation from Oregon State Police, Oregon Emergency Management, the Oregon Department of Transportation, Oregon State Sheriff's Association, Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police, the Oregon Emergency Communication Committee, which oversees the EAS system, and the Oregon Association of Broadcasters, or the OAB. In conducting its business, the planning group consulted with Washington County Emergency Management, Tualatin Police Department, and many others around the country in development of the Oregon Plan. Washington County, as you all may remember, was in the lead in Oregon in developing a regional Amber Plan within the state. The group, in conducting their business and developing the plan, essentially defined a four-point criteria, which is the statewide adopted criteria for activation of a Amber Alert. And within that, they developed the statewide process for use of the system and getting the information out. In October of last year, the planning group presented the proposed statewide criteria and process in the form of a proposal back to the Governor's Public Safety Policy and Planning Council, which was adopted at that time. And on October 28th, as has been previously mentioned, Governor Kitzhaber formally announced the through an executive order the statewide Amber Alert system and proposed at that time that the system be implemented statewide. The executive order also required that the planning group become the Amber Alert Review Committee once the system was implemented, and that is in place today. I chair that, and with the same representatives from those industries that I mentioned as part of the review group, and our purpose is to enhance the current system and also to review any actual activations of the system that may occur in the future. In mid-November of 2002, we activated the system in Oregon, and it is in place today, and it is operational. Oregon is one of 35 states in this country to have a statewide Amber Alert system. In your packet of material that I provided, in addition to the testimony, you've got a schematic which shows the process that we follow in Oregon, which has been adopted by the broadcast industry, the Oregon Chiefs and Sheriffs Associations, and the Oregon State Police, and also, of course, the statewide criteria that I had mentioned. In summary, what the plan does in Oregon, it provides for a single and uniform statewide toll-free Amber Alert tip line. It's 1-866-5-AMBER-5, which has a nice jingle that people can remember. It provides for a single alert criteria and process for activation of the system statewide. And a key feature of the system is that it can be used by any law enforcement agency in the state of Oregon, whether that be large or small, urban or rural. They can sign up and participate and have that as a resource if indeed they end up in a situation with a confirmed child abduction and there are contingencies in the plan that if they are not able to staff a the tip line that we can do that at the state level, or we can electronically toss them the 1-800 line and they can staff their own tip line. Again, those details of the process and the criteria are in your packet. Referencing the Senate Bill 8 that's before you today, it essentially, as I've testified, the Amber Plan is in place today. We continue to add enhancements to it from the perspective of the review committee to add more robustness to it in the sense of being able to not only use the emergency alert system to get information out to the public, but if we can use MSN, who's been interested in doing it, the Oregon Trucking Association's been interested in partnering with us, PGE is interested in partnering with us to be able to use their technologies that when we have a confirmed case, then we can have a ring down list through Oregon Emergency Management to get the information out broader than just the emergency alert system that's on your television or radio. It's really a policy choice, I believe, by this committee to determine whether or not it ought to be in statute and in a rule. It will work in either case. There is, however, something to be mindful of, and that is my understanding is at the federal level, Congress is again looking at a federal Amber system. And in those discussions, we're picking up a little information that one of the things that could come out of that would be standardization of states' AMBER criteria. We do believe that it ought to be a state criteria so that it's uniform within the state, so that you're not having to interpret different criteria. However, that may change in the future depending on what Congress does as far as nationally requiring some kind of uniformity, and that would cause Oregon to perhaps change its established criteria. But we'll have to wait for the future to determine whether or not that occurs or not.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, sir.
Do you know what the timeline for the federal decision-making is? Or have you gotten any wind of that?
Mr. Chair, I do not know what that is. And that really essentially concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have. And thank you.
Senator Minnis?
Senator Walker.
Senator Walker?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Minnis. I have a question because you have a concern. You said it would work either way, whether it was in statute or not. But then I was reading your testimony, and your testimony was that you don't see any further enhancement that will incur by passage of this bill. So then that tells me that you don't really think the bill is necessary. And third, if Congress does pass a federal AMBER plan and ask states to conform with that, can't we do that with this legislation because you're developing it? We're asking you to develop by rule the criteria.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, we still believe that it would work in either case, whether this bill as written became law. The system that we have in place today and the plans for it will continue, and it'll be a good, viable system. The issue of whether or not we would need to change the criteria if Congress does mandate some kind of a standardization of criteria across the country would just require us to go into the rulemaking process, and that just takes additional time to do. We can do that. If it's in law and that's what's required to establish the criteria and rule, we wouldn't oppose doing that. We don't believe it would be necessary, however, as it is now. We've been able to develop the system and work with our partners at all levels within Oregon and to establish the current system, and it's working quite well.
And so if I might follow up then, so you have the current system in place, and if Congress acts on this, you would just change the current system to meet the new federal standard?
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, yes, what we would do is the review committee, which is by the executive order tasked with the oversight of the current system, would convene a meeting, and we would work with partners, as we did in the front end, to develop the system to modify the state criteria and adopt it based on the federal requirements.
Okay. So. All right, thank you. That answers my question.
You know, Senator Minnis, one thing I'm thinking about this is that the structure that they use to develop the alert system under the governor's executive order was a pretty detailed, you know, list of participants and,
you know, had those participants become the review committee. I'm wondering if that is, I mean, it would seem like this bill isn't intended to recreate the wheel. I wonder if we would need to put some reference to the existing committee, that review committee that put this together in the first place.
Well, I think, Mr. Chairman, I think that the way the bill's drafted, it's pretty flexible, and I guess that gets to one of the questions I wanted to ask the major. In terms of establishing criteria, I think you could establish criteria fairly generally. The agency has general rulemaking authority. One of the criteria could be that there shall be an advisory committee. You create by rule, or actually by policy, what that advisory committee is. In other words, it's kind of a subterranean thing under the rulemaking authority. So the rules can be very flexible. I don't see that that there's a problem. I really don't care much if the Congress passes their own nationalized standard, because, frankly, I don't know what that does for us. I mean, if they provide money, then wonderful. Then maybe there's an incentive to do that. But, you know, the Congress does some interesting things from time to time. But it is important, I think, that we have a functional system. It looks like we have one so far. But I do think there's probably a compelling reason to put it in statute with a broad range of flexibility and rule. I have one question for the major. In the executive order, the governor included in subsection 3, a command that says that all state agencies shall cooperate fully with the Department of Oregon State Police and the Oregon Emergency Management to provide assistance as needed in the executive order. That particular paragraph is not included in the bill, which is interesting. That seemed to be probably one of the more important parts of the executive order, is the compelling a command to cooperate. As my experience in law enforcement is that agencies from time to time do not cooperate.
Mr. Chair, Senator Mennison, in developing this system, the cooperation has been outstanding. We did it in 2 months' time at multiple levels of government that we needed to get working together in the same direction. We all did. They were just wonderful. Of course, executive order would only compel or be applicable to state agencies.
Right.
And the AMBER system involves much broader cutting down to all levels of government. So.
And Mr. Chairman, Major, that's the point I'm getting to, is if you had a local agency that activated the AMBER alert system, but there was a need to kind of hook back into the state system, if the local police agency called the Department of Human Resources and said, we'd like to have all the information you have on this particular family, et cetera, I could envision, although they generally work together through the child abuse teams and such, I could envision someone saying, we can't give you that information because it's confidential. But if there's a state statute that says you shall cooperate in the AMBER system, then that at least opens a door for the information to be released.
Okay.
Oh, there I am.
Thank you very much. Any other questions of Commander Wolter? Thank you very much, Greg.
Thank you, sir. And just one final comment. I just want to thank Senator Starr and Senator Courtney for their support last fall when we were putting this together. We felt their presence. And as we put this together and worked with all the different partners around the state, and just appreciate their leadership in this and getting it established. Thank you.
It's amazing you got it done in such a time and fashion with Senator Courtney involved. That's great. Larry Hatch.
Thank you. Larry Hatch, I'm the Assistant Director with Washington County 911, and I wanted to come today with a special thank you to Senator Starr for making me aware that the bill was up for hearing to support Senate Bill 8. It's something that's been a personal and professional issue for me for probably about 9-10 months now, and the work that we did on it in Washington County. And Senator Starr did contact us early on in the process, and we will have, hopefully on March 7th, a community notification system in place for our residents in Washington County, and to take into account the Truckers Association and those people, that when we have an AMBER alert, we'll be able to send out mass notifications using that system just to enhance what we have, what we're able to do, and partner along with Oregon Emergency Management as well as we develop those kinds of lists together. So thank you for your time, and I'd be glad to answer any questions if you had any.
Any questions, Mr. Hatch? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Hatch, for coming. Okay, we will have Pete Shepherd in the AG's office, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepherd. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. Attorney General Hardy Myers sits on the Governor's Public Safety Policy and Planning Council and was pleased to help with the state police effort and the effort of other law enforcement agencies to initiate the system that Oregon does have. And he also is pleased to support Senate Bill 8, though he couldn't be here this afternoon. To what has already been said, let me just add two general comments. First, in a former life, I was a criminal prosecutor, and I can attest from my own experience that the more quickly the offender is apprehended, the less injury there is likely to be to the victim, and the higher the probability of a successful prosecution. So to the extent that the Amber Alert system can assist in the rapid apprehension of one of these offenders, it serves both a prosecution function as well as an investigative function. And the second observation would be with respect to the rulemaking process. As members of the committee probably know, part of the Administrative Procedures Act rulemaking process is that an agency that proposes to make rules either has to convene a rulemaking advisory committee or explain in the rulemaking why they didn't do that. And so there is in the Administrative Procedures Act already a built-in mechanism by which the state police could, if they chose to do that, to activate, in effect, many of the same partners that they've already cultivated for this. So that is, in fact, implicit in the bill that the committee has before it.
That's very helpful. Thank you, Mr. Shepherd. Can I answer one of my questions, Senator Menace?
Yeah. Pete, I'm sitting here thinking maybe too much about the bill, but to the extent that they have participants who are not government agencies, local media, who would be clearly, I think, covered under First Amendment issues and such, but you have private parties involved, and they participate in the Amber Alert, but I'm assuming you have an Amber Alert that turns out to be false. Is there any potential civil liability for any of the participants who've been part of the system with a false allegation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, there are, in fact, torts that are based upon wrongful accusation of a criminal act, and I wouldn't be a very effective lawyer if I told you that it was impossible that somebody would get sued successfully for participating in this. I can tell you that just from a jury appeal standpoint, I don't think it's a very appealing case to be suing somebody because they participated in an attempt to apprehend someone as to whom there was some objective reason to think that they had committed a serious criminal offense. So I wouldn't see those cases have much appeal, but I can't guarantee you that somebody wouldn't be sued as a result of participating.
And I'll only ask that to ask whether it might be prudent to refer this back to some, you know, the Good Samaritan law or something, or good faith.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, it does entangle you in some of the constitutional limitations on the capacity of the government to eliminate causes of action that the Oregon Constitution generally prohibits the government from prohibiting lawsuits that were available to citizens at common law at the time the Oregon Constitution was enacted. And so there are some constitutional limitations on your ability as a body to limit the liability of folks. That's not an opinion that you couldn't write something constitutionally, but it would make it a considerably more complicated bill than you have.
But we have traditionally done that for first aid and such on.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, there is indeed a Good Samaritan statute, and there are other, even this session, there are some proposals involving aid during the aftermath of a terrorist attack, for example, that involve liability limitations.
Mr. Chairman, I tend to agree that I think the jury appeal would be virtually non-existent, but can't limit the possibilities out there of people's imagination to sue. So.
Right. Thank you. Any further questions, Mr. Shepard? Seeing none, thanks a lot, Mr. Shepard. Now we'll have very, very brief discussion with Mr. Doug Tindall of the Department of Transportation. You want to come up and say anything, Mr. Russell? Okay.
There's a smile, right. smile back on Mr. Tindall's face now that I wish he is hired a rehired.
Yes, very positive sign. Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Doug Tindall, the state maintenance engineer for the Department of Transportation. The bill and the progress that we've made in implementing the AMBER plan has been very well explained, and so I'm not going to explain it again. I'd like to express a couple of thank yous, first to Larry Hatch from Washington County, who did a real good job on starting to bring people together, and secondly to Major Williford, who did just a superlative job in bringing a whole bunch more people together from across the state, and also amazing that the progress that we were able to make in a very short period of time. With that, I'd answer any questions the committee has.
Thank you very much. Any questions, Mr. Tindall? Thank you, Doug. Appreciate it. Well, colleagues, I think we should move the bill. Any strong objection to that? You okay? Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll close the public hearing and open the work session on Senate Bill 8.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Starr.
Move Senate Bill 8 to the Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Starr moves Senate Bill 8 to the floor, unamended with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Just a little.
Senator Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to thank everyone involved in this. I had one of Representative Prozanski's constituents came to me last April and presented me with this document dated in March, Oregon's AMBER plan, and I put him in touch with the governor's office to work on it, and I believe he did that. And I appreciated Pete Shepard bringing this forward here, this piece from the web on the Amber Alert Now organization, the Poly Class Foundation, because even though we had testimony that the bill may or may not be necessary, one of the things that they advocate here for is that we push for statewide plans first, because the federal plan, you know, we just want to get them in place. And we've done a great job here in Oregon in getting it in place, and I think we'll continue to do well. And
okay. Senator Miss?
Chairman, I just want to compliment the Senate President for acknowledging the fact that you disrespected me while I was here, bringing this kind of bill. Of course, in my history working in this body with him, he is a very compassionate man who has tirelessly worked on issues relevant to children and their protection. So I think it's a good bill. Personally, I think we could have enhanced the bill a little bit, but I'm not going to hold it up and see what the House wants to do with it.
Well, despite Senator Courtney's good efforts, we will move the bill forward. So, Ms. Gravel, would you call the roll, please?
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chairman?
Aye.
Chair Booker?
Aye. Senate Bill 8 is passed, and we will have Senator Starr, I presume, and maybe Senator Courtney will co-carry it, I would guess. So, thank you very much. Close hearing on Senate Bill 8. And we will, I want to just stand adjourned for just a second, or not adjourned, excuse me, just stand aside for just a second.
You shut the mic off, man.
Yes. Is there an action that needs to be taken to do that?
Recess.
We'll recess for 2.5 minutes.
There you go.
Yes. Okay. Mr. Ellsworth, can you tell us what this bill does, please?
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, Senate Bill 266 subjects appointment of the Director of Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to Senate confirmation.
Thank you very much. Our first witness is Bob Wolf. Welcome, Mr. Wolf.
Good afternoon, Chair Corcoran, members of the committee. I'm Sheriff Bob Wolf. I'm Sheriff of Polk County, and I also serve as the co-chair for the, or vice chair, I should say, of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training Board, and I serve as the chair of the Corrections Policy Committee. On Senate Bill 266, I have some paperwork should be coming to you. I'm here to testify today in opposition to this, and the reason for that is that currently the full board of the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training consists of 23 members already. It's probably one of the largest boards around, and with the current cutbacks of a lot of things that are going on in our state right now, I somewhat question why we would need to add another member to this board. One of the things that I'm concerned. Yes.
This is subject's appointment of director of, to Senate confirmation.
Yeah, my apologies, Mr. Chair. This one, I got two of them here. This one here is dealing with the issue of Senate appointment, and my apologies.
That's fine. We do that on the floor, don't we, Senator Menes?
I've given speeches on the floor.
Senator Menes gave a speech on the wrong bill the other day. It was wonderful.
Right. And everybody voted for it.
Yeah.
Good thing. Very good.
Okay.
This one here is dealing with the Senate appointment. And back in 1997, when the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training was created, considerable thought went into the process of creating that board. And currently, what is under statute is that when a director is to be considered for appointment, that goes to the governor after a recommendation by the DPSSD board, which consists of 23 members. Three names are forwarded to the governor for his consideration, or hers, depending upon the governor at the time. And we really see no reason at all for there to be Senate confirmation for this position. The makeup of the DPSST board has a citizen appointed to it, as well as various members of the public safety community out there. So you have police officers, you have security, you have fire. All of the makeup of the public safety community is involved in this committee, and it's their makeup that I think validates the reason why those three people should be selected and forwarded to the governor for his selection. And so, therefore, on February 18th, when the Corrections Policy Committee met, that I chair, we voted to oppose this Bill 266, and I also serve as a co-chair for the Oregon State Sheriff's Association Legislative Committee, and the Oregon State Sheriff's Association took a neutral position on this bill.
Okay. Thank you, Sheriff. Any questions, Sheriff?
No.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Now we'll have the two proponents of the measure, Mary Botkin and Brian DeLashmet. Would you guys like to come up?
Brian and I always get in trouble when we testify together, so.
That's what I was hoping.
Can I sit back? Well, you sit in this chair and she can sit
in this chair. That's why we have three chairs up here. They keep one between you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Botkin. I'm here today representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. And we actually asked for the introduction of Senate Bill 269. Roughly 1,200 of our 266. I'm sorry. Roughly 1,200 of our public safety members asked that this bill be introduced, as your ability as state senators to have an opportunity to properly interview the person who will head one of the largest agencies for public safety, the largest agency in the state of Oregon, responsible for the training programs of every public safety officer in Oregon. We believe that this agency has an awesome responsibility, and that more oversight is good, not less, and that when we put the lottery commissioner in front of you for Senate confirmation, or when we put the head of the OLCC in front of you for Senate confirmation, we probably ought to put the head of DPSST in front of you for Senate confirmation as well. It just makes sense to us to have a check and balance in which you are included, and require that some oversight in conjunction with the governor's appointment be available to you. Seems like good policy to us.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Ms. Bug? Seeing none. Mr. DeLashman?
For the record, I'm Brian DeLashman. I'm representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations and the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees. I won't repeat what Ms. Bodkin has indicated, but both of my associations are in support of this bill. And what I typically hear from the associations is that they have very little ability to influence the appointment of this particular agency head. And you heard from the previous speaker that, of course, the board, 23-member board, is the one that gets to decide the three names that go forward, and the governor gets to decide that. Well, you'll hear when we talk about 267 why that concerns us, because there is not adequate balance on that board. We feel that line officers in this state, both corrections and in police line officers, have very little ability to influence a decision that's critical to their profession, their ability to practice, the standards that they have to be governed under. So we would support the bill.
Okay, thank you very much. Any questions? Okay. Colleagues, I think we'll sit on this one for a little while. Maybe the, you know, a message has been given here that Mr. Wolf can take back, probably. And so with that, we'll close public hearing on 266, and we'll open up public hearing on 267. Would you like to tell us what 267 does, Mr. Ellsworth?
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, Senate Bill 267 creates position on Board of Public Safety Standards and Training for representative of largest collective bargaining unit of Department of Corrections. Creates position on Corrections Policy Committee for female employee of Department of Corrections employed at Women's Correction Facility.
Why don't we reverse the order this time, since this was introduced? We'll have the proponents up first then, so if you guys want to come up separately or as a group, Mary Bodkin, Brian DeLashmet, I see Bob Livingston has, you want to come up too, Bob?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm going to hand out a current makeup of the current DPSST board and the Corrections Policy Advisory Committee. And I'm doing that for a very good reason. And I'm going to start with the board first, if you will. On this board, there are roughly that we can identify two or three rank and file members who patrol the streets or work in the tiers in a correctional facility. We believe that there's probably, you know, we're not going to speak to fire because we don't know who's rank and file and who's not. I just want to speak to law enforcement and public and corrections. Our concern is that we have been unable to effectively influence the makeup of this board to reflect the needs of people who do the work every day. And we've been frustrated with trying to influence this department to be more responsive to the needs of the officers and the men and women who work in public safety, law enforcement, and in corrections, and including them in decisions that affect the way they're trained, how they're trained, what they're trained to do, and the changes in current training practices. Additionally, we are frustrated with the fact that this board is, one, huge, two, unrepresentative, and three, completely out of step with the modern workforce. If you will note, there are very few females sitting on this board. And in fact, one of the two or three that do sit on this board is a public citizen. Certainly we have no problem with that. And I want to be very clear that we don't have a problem with any board member here. And in fact, we think that we can even make some fairly significant arguments that those folks ought to stay there until such time as we can restructure the whole board. And Senator Minnis and I have had this discussion. But to continue to deny the largest bargaining unit, which represents over 1,000 folks in corrections, a position on this board, is not acceptable to us any longer. We have no interest in replacing, and I want to talk about the Corrections Policy Committee as well, but we have no interest in replacing somebody who's currently on there. What we're interested in doing is adding somebody and adding on the larger board, very specifically somebody, and on the Corrections Policy Committee, we want to add a female member of the corrections contingent of public safety. If you look at the Corrections Policy Committee, there is one woman on the board who is now retired. Sonia Hoyt may still be working back in the Dome Building, and certainly when she was a superintendent of the women's facility, we certainly had a lot of respect for Sonia. We've known her for years. It's not the issue. The issue is there's one woman. She's retired now. If we want to recruit, which we do actively, women into the service of corrections as a beginning place for a lifetime career in public safety, we ought to have somebody on this committee that looks like them. Just one. Or maybe two. Because more and more women are entering this line of employment, especially as we build in Eastern Oregon and expand over there. There is one person eligible for collective bargaining on the Corrections Policy Committee, Mr. Harkins. Mr. Harkins works at the Oregon State Penitentiary, and I can make a compelling argument that as the institution, it is the only institution that has the death penalty and, in fact, is charged at this point with the execution of those facing the death sentence, that Mr. Harkins and his members have some very specific needs in relationship to that. But I can make the same argument that folks who work at the Eastern Oregon Correctional Facility or at the Snake River Facility or at the Women's Facility also have very specific needs. There has been absolutely no ability to work with this department to do this in a non-confrontive manner. We can't seem to get anybody on these boards. We don't have a choice but to come to you and ask for some redress on this.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Sorry, any questions? Ms. Plotkin? No.
Okay. For the record, again, I'm Brian DeLeishman, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations and the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees. I won't, again, go over ground that Mary has covered. Let me touch on a couple of points. In the previous bill, when I talked about balance and the ability to retain the executive director by the board, I was specifically talking about the composition that you've just seen. I can think of absolutely no other board in this state that has the ability to set standards, discipline, and revoke somebody's ability to practice profession that is so unbalanced. If you look at the boards and commissions that I'm familiar with, Board of Nursing, Board of Medical Examiners, Board of Dentistry, Board of Pharmacy, it is made up of peers. There is both in the nursing areas, nurse educators, nurse managers, but there are also an equal number of those practicing the profession. I believe that when you are setting the standards, you're setting the training standards, and that you also have the ability to discipline or revoke somebody from practice and profession, that these officers have the right to be judged by their peers. And this board is not their peers at the present time. So directly to 267, we have no specific problem with 267, but we think there is a broader problem. We would like to see, if not this bill expanded, another bill that basically reconstitutes the entire board and its process to be a more balanced board that represents all the parties that have an interest in the training standards and the discipline of officers in this state. With that, I'll add one additional thing, just so you're aware of. If we go that one step further and decide to do something along these lines, here's another concern that I have. Recently, a board appointment of a line officer, one of, I believe, the brightest young line officers in the state that I've worked with, had the opportunity to work with, and quite frankly, I had to go all the way to the wall with an employer in order to be able to get to that officer, that appointment, because the employer was not willing to give that officer the time off, even without pay, to serve on that board. So if we were going to look at the issue of the board composition and so forth, that's one additional issue that I'll be bringing forward, is the ability for somebody to serve on this, whether it's with pay or without pay, but an employer should not have the ability to bar somebody from being appointed just simply by saying, Officer XYZ, you can't serve because I'm not going to allow you to have the time off to serve on this policy board.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Walker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. DeLashmet, you seem pretty angry about this bill. I'm getting that from your body language. And I want to ask you this question, because I'm looking here at the makeup. Were you here when this bill was originally passed in 1997 that set out all of the members of the board?
Senator Corcoran, Senator Walker, I did not represent police officers and corrections folks at that time. So although I've been in the building since 1977 and represented clients of 79, this was not an issue for me at that point.
Okay.
Since my being retained by both entities, this is an issue that I hear over and over and over again from them. And last session, we attempted and actually did accomplish adding an additional police officer, an additional firefighter, and an additional corrections officer onto the policy groups, which made two on each of those. But if you still look at the composition, it is extremely unbalanced. And yes, I am very passionate about it because my members are very passionate about it. And when I hear it every time I get together with them, we've got to do something about this, then they've got my attention, and I hope I've gotten your attention.
Well, you did, sir, and I was just curious how come this was so unbalanced in your opinion. It made it through the building and through the governor's office in this state. And Mary, were you here in 97 and representing these employees?
She was. It's her fault.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker.
There's probably a story here I don't
know
about.
Well, no, I have to tell you. I mean, it got through over our screaming bodies. I mean,
okay.
You know, I think that it is a very frustrating thing. It took us, I will tell you, it took me 10 years to get corrections officers into DPSST to be certified. Before that, they kind of got training hit and miss. And Senator Corcoran remembers those days.
I think it was only the second or third class of corrections when I went through it.
I mean, this is a very entrenched system now. And Senator Walker, I'm sorry I didn't fight harder. I'm sorry we didn't bring a bunch of uniforms to the building. It's very frustrating. Yeah. I mean, I suppose we could line up all of our female corrections officers and bring them into the building and say, you know, we deserve a voice too.
Mm-hmm.
But
that's not necessary. And I'm not asking for your apology. I just sometimes when we get things like this, I just want to know the background why you're here today. When
we've been trying for a couple of sessions,
and that's my background.
Actually tried to do it without having to pass a law.
And I see you came by my office on the 4th and probably couldn't find time to see me because I'm in committee so much, so I would have gotten that. So I appreciate your answers. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Senator Minnis.
I kind of give my routine dissertation on this whole issue. I think it's fair to say that the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, which used to be called the Board of Police Safety Standards and Training, et cetera, is one of those organizations that is constant transition. And Senator Walker, partly, this bill came through my Judiciary Committee in 1997 when I served in the House of Representatives, and it was the first attempt on my part and other members' parts to try to reorganize the Department of Public Safety Standards Training, which was, in my opinion, at that time, dysfunctional and not working well. I still hold the opinion that the Department of Public Safety Standards Training does not function well. We did some transition during the last legislative session in terms of giving certain, you know, purview to smaller groups within the department. But it isn't necessarily the department's fault. And again, I want to kind of add that caveat. The legislature has been to some degree responsible for this. So, and there's also been kind of an evolutionary transition in law enforcement and corrections. You see more females entering into law enforcement nowadays. You see more women going into these professions that you didn't see 25 years ago when I started. There were all of, what, I think 10 in the Portland Police Bureau at the time. So there has been a transition and evolution of personnel going into these departments. We've also increased, you know, corrections, et cetera. The other thing that's come up time and again that we don't do well is the discipline of persons working in this area. And this board really doesn't function well, like, it doesn't function like the Board of Medical Examiners. In terms of meting out discipline, I think a case that you might recall is the chief of police in a small city in Washington County here recently who resisted the termination of this, you know, the pulling of their certification. It's a power that the board has, but one that they use very infrequently. And so I guess what I'm saying in saying all of this is it's really no one's fault. I think that the legislature should look at this as an agency that is in process. And different governors have had different views of how things should function. The current climate we find ourselves in is after we did our restructuring from the last legislative session, the unitary assessment monies, which you may be familiar with in our state system, now called CFA, or criminal forfeiture account, we had 50% of that money would go into the general fund, 50% of it roughly would go into public safety agencies, and the department had, there were resources there. Last session, because of the building of the public safety facility, which is now on hold, and I've not gotten an update on the status of that, we moved the line up to a little higher so that there was more money actually going into the general fund for the budgetary reasons, and then we front-loaded the building of the facility. This governor, and I don't know that Ted's done this intentionally, but I think as a bit it came out of DAS, 70% of CFA goes into the general fund. So as time goes on, the agency's ability to do its job gets compressed by resources. So one of the things that I've said, I think, numerous times to a number of people that I've transmitted this message to, the governor's office and Craig Campbell, is I think that the legislature, and particularly the governor, we need to have a large discussion about where we're going with public safety standards and training, mm-hmm. with training officers. Mm-hmm. We are, I think, as far as training, pretty dismal compared to other states. I think I'm not sure what our current training modality is. Is it 10 weeks now?
It's 10 weeks and we're supposed to go to 16.
10 weeks, supposed to go to 16, and I think there are national standards that suggest 25 is an appropriate time frame. So we just don't put the kind of money into it. And in the last legislative session, I put a provision in the bill that would have forced all agencies, and current law does this, forced all agencies into the Basic Police Academy, which is now on hold for budgetary purposes, which that law may not be a good thing given where we're going. So again, I guess I'm saying all that to say that the committee should consider these bills and other bills for DPSST kind of in the totality of the circumstances with the agency and how it's currently constructed and how effective it is, and literally with hopefully the governor's office and Craig Campbell leading the way with respect to where we need to go here. Personally, I'd like to see the Department of Public Safety Standards Training have more money. I think CFA, a large portion, should be dedicated to this purpose because I think we need more training for law enforcement, particularly at the basic level. We're not doing it. I introduced a piece of legislation this session that basically gives a private right of action to any person who's harmed by any officer who has not been trained to a national standard.
Well, and Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, if I can, one of the things that you bring up is very important because more and more what we're seeing in corrections is more and more time at the front end where officers are actually working on the job prior to getting their training through DPSST. You know, we are certainly strong advocates for an appropriately funded agency, though it's hard for us to advocate for an agency that has failed to keep pace with the changing work environment, with the changing workforce, and that doesn't look like the workforce looks.
Mr. Chairman, Mary, in an open argument with you, I don't disagree with you, but the agency has been hamstrung by having to use part-time instructors from all over the state and trying to have a training mission to meet all of the various modalities of all the various agencies around the state. And in my opinion, it is just simply, from our view in the legislature and from the executive branch of this government, has not been handled well. There isn't clear policy. There needs to be clear policy. I just think, having spent 27 years in law enforcement, you don't give someone the liberty or the power to take someone's liberty away or take their very life away and not give them a foundation of adequate training. It is stupid, in my opinion, and frankly, the finger gets pointed at us for not doing it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I don't think we have a disagreement.
Right, I understand. I'm saying this kind of lay the foundation, because I'm assuming the governor's office or Craig watching. Yeah. I'm hoping he is, because I've said this to him directly. I'm hoping that, I know that this may not rise to a high level of attention for the governor right now, given the budget circumstances and others. But there are people, I think, who are willing to take some of these things on and try to work. So.
Well, given our budget circumstances, I was thinking of doing some further training at DPSST on financing, creative financing, use of police for that, but we can talk about that later.
Some bills for that too.
Okay. We have an actual member of the board here now. Mr. Livingston?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Livingston, and I represent the Oregon State Firefighters Council. And as the chair alluded to, I am also a member of the board and also the chair of the Fire Policy Committee. So I think I could probably give you a little bit of perspective on at least some of my thoughts in that. But I also want to make it clear that my thoughts today are my personal thoughts and the thoughts of my organization. I'm not speaking on behalf of the chair of the Fire Policy Committee, only speaking on behalf of my organization that I'm representing here today. However, having said that, I think one of the things that we have done, well, actually that you have done as a step in the right direction, is you really have codified the various policy committees, because similar to this organization that we're in this body that we're in, a lot of the legwork and the policy work that gets done in the committees. And I do believe that that was a step in the right direction of my experience. Having been in that transition now to where we do have codified committees, looking at the end product that comes to the board, comparatively speaking to what used to come at the board when we really didn't have that codification, I can say, in my opinion, we do have a little bit better policy direction. We get a better end product. However, as Mr. Vice Chair did note on that, there are some other concerns that I think all of the board members would agree, because certainly with the Vice Chair Minnis with respect to funding and all of those issues. But specifically the Senate Bill 267, one of the things in my experience that I believe is worthwhile, and I think both of my colleagues have noted that, is that in my impression, I think that there is some room for additional members that are worker bees in the blue-collar type folks to be on the corrections committee. I think if that's where most of the policy work is going to be done, and in fact that's where it is going to be done, I think there should be balance. I think any time that you have balance between labor management and a different perspective, variations of what jobs that you do within those organizations, you're going to come up with the end with a better product. And I think as a board member and someone that takes my position on the board very seriously, the end result of what we're trying to do when we present policy is do what's right for the citizens of Oregon and to try to do the best under some tough, difficult times to do what our charge is, and that is to present policy to do the best we can as far as setting standards and training for our public safety officers. And with that, I just think that this bill does have some merit, particularly with the fact that I think there should be a little bit better balance on the correction committee, and would support the addition of having some more people that are actually on the front lines, if I could, and doing the work on a daily basis. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Livingston. I think that you make an excellent point in terms of the balance. So often the you know, the frontline workers, whether it's in child protective services or adult and family services or in law enforcement, the people that are actually doing the rank and file don't have a voice in the procedures, and it can range from being dangerous to just plain ineffective. So I thank you for your testimony. Any questions of Mr. Livingston? Senator?
Well, not Mr. Livingston, the panel. Is there a need in this bill to compel an agency to release someone to be part of the board or to participate if there's some kind of...
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, if you have an interest in that particular area, I would be more than happy to have an amendment drafted to that extent. Again, it was a major chore to get one of the current line officers, police line officers, released from an agency in the state. And I think he was the most qualified and one of the best and the brightest in the state to be on that. And it just about didn't happen. So I think that would be a good idea.
Mr. Chair, and I'm not going to, I do know that the corrections, the rank and file member of the corrections advisory committee has some spotty attendance record, and I assume that's for the same reason. That, you know, these are rank and file folks, and if you're not wearing a uniform in an office, it's very hard for you to get the time off to go to these meetings. And so I do think it's important that we compel the employing agencies, even though we've talked with the agency that we're concerned with, and they have committed to us that they will make arrangements to let folks get there. It still is very challenging because, I mean, somebody else has to work overtime to cover up. Mm-hmm. That's the reality.
I could see that being treated as an unfunded mandate on one level.
It doesn't reach the constitutional test, but it seems disingenuous to put people on a board mm-hmm. and then not allow them to attend.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a statewide interest to make the system function
yeah.
well. So, yeah.
And I do think it's important that Mr. Harkin is able to attend without fear of retribution or some kind of worksite problem. As a result yeah. of anything.
Thank you, folks, very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Wolf, Sheriff Wolf.
I think if you give us a second.
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Sheriff Bob Wolf, Sheriff Polk County, and I'm here to talk about Senate Bill 267.
That's a good thing.
All right. One of the concerns that, and I'm here to speak in opposition to this bill, one of the concerns that comes to mind with me on this is that it actually excludes representation of all of those who work in county facilities. I mean, they're looking for, the way the bill's currently written, they're looking to put someone on there that's specifically from the Department of Corrections. If we're looking at adding someone from a union representation base, then we should probably also look at, you know, having someone from county union representation.
That sounds like a good idea.
Well, having said that, my concern also, as I testified previously on 266, is adding additional people to the board. I personally feel strong opposition to this from the standpoint of, I think it's an attempt to try to unionize the policy committee. We have non-represented people on that committee already, and they are there. They have a fair share and are allowed to speak. So I guess I have some significant concerns over that. As the chair of the Police Policy Committee, or Corrections Policy Committee, I can't recall any issues that have ever come before my particular board that were dealing with union issues. Most of them are dealing with issues of policy on training, and they're dealing with issues such as certification requirements. Most labor issues should be handled, you know, at the agency
and with the respective labor organizations, and I don't believe that they should be before a policy committee. If this provision were established, I guess I would also question why maybe the email has to be from the Department of Corrections. Why could it not be from another branch? I just have concerns because of the fact that it seems to exclude representation from counties. The bill also, as it's written, in my view, creates a gender-specific member. It's found on the Corrections Policy Committee board. It's not found on any other board. And for that reason, on February 18th, when the Corrections Policy Committee reviewed this bill, we voted in opposition to the proposal. And also, as the co-chair of the Oregon State Sheriff Association, this bill has come before that group, and we've also taken an opposition stance on that bill.
Well, Sheriff, do you think having two women out of 23 members represents any kind of gender balance?
Actually, as the chair of the committee, I could look to appoint, other folks from the different groups that are represented. I mean, if they wanted to bring someone that's female forward, we could do that. I mean, it's not been an issue of looking to say, well, we're only going to take males from this group or males from another group.
I guess my other question, Sheriff, is I can't quite understand why policies that deal with the kind of safety issues that I would assume are a big part of what you do would be developed in a vacuum without the input of rank and file workers. Amazes me that, I mean, it sounds very ivory towerish that somehow you could have a policy being made that can really affect the training and the safety of these personal safety and as Senator Menes has pointed out, you're talking about the public safety if it's in the non-correction arena, in the law enforcement arena, without the a balanced input from the people who actually perform the work. Can you speak to that? I'm just perplexed about that notion.
Chair Corcoran, the balance, I guess, becomes more of an issue because of the language that's written here that brings my concern to the fact that it's a gender issue. If we're talking, non-management staff, represented staff, then that, that's another issue for this bill to look at. Line staff, they're the front workers. They're the ones that are out there doing the job. I've not really seen any issues that have come before the Corrections Policy Committee, though, that have not been represented well through the membership that's currently on that board, in which we get into some pretty good discussions relative to the impacts of how this will affect the line staff.
Okay, thanks. Any other questions? Senator Walker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sheriff, I was a little surprised at your comment that you're characterizing this as a union issue and an attempt to unionize the board. I didn't really get that impression myself, and I saw it more as an opportunity for the members who are people who are directly on the front line involved in public safety to provide input rather than managerial people and those sorts of folks. I'm not quite sure why you characterize it as a union issue.
Chair Cochran, Senator Walker, I guess based on the drafting of the memo and the fact that it specifically points out that it should be a bargaining unit member, that's the reason that I take issue with the fact that it appears to me to be a union issue.
Well, I guess I'd respond that aren't the workers unionized? I suppose if they're not, then it wouldn't have been characterized that way.
Senator Parker and Senator Walker, the fact that it's specifically based off of they have to be a bargaining unit member. There's other non-management people there that could be union members as well.
I see.
Any other questions there, sir?
Yeah, just I'm looking at the statute, looking at the bill. Is there a quorum requirement necessary for the board to do business?
Chair Cochran, Senator Starr, yes, that's correct. And that's another issue that really creates some problems for us at times is we have difficulty in obtaining a quorum. And further expansion of the board makes it more difficult for us to get a quorum.
Is it you have to have 50% or of the members there or something like that? Is that the quorum requirement?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, any other Senator Moose?
How often do you meet?
Chair Parkrin and Senator Minnis. Generally, it's once a quarter or at any other time that there's issues that come before the policy committee that needs to be addressed.
Okay. In the last year, how often did you meet?
I believe we met four times, sir.
Four times. All right. I know the director's here. I'd like to get the attendance records of all of the current members of the board for the last 2 years. And I'm asking that because I'm very interested in the folks that serve by virtue of their office. It's current law. I'd like to know specifically whether the superintendent of state police has attended regularly, or the chief of police for the Portland Police Bureau, the state fire marshal, chief of police of the Portland Fire Bureau, director of the Department of Corrections, or special agent in charge of the FBI. And I want to specifically look at whether or not their participation is fully involved, if you will.
Okay. And can you talk to your staff about getting that enforced?
I think the director just took a note back here.
Oh, okay. Director's here. Okay. That answered my question. Yes.
With the gender issue, what about making half the members female and half the members male? Just in general.
Is this by surgery or by appointment?
I'm not going there.
Sure. Oh, my God. What are we doing?
I don't mean making it. I get his name. All right. His Irish are good.
I guess that would set some new standards as far as the makeup of the policy committee.
Do you think it would affect the decision making?
Personally, no.
Thank you.
Senator? Senator Starr?
Oh, I just had a thought, but I'll keep it in my thought.
Okay. About the surgery thing?
Okay, thank you very much, Sheriff.
Okay,
we will close the work session, public hearing on Senate Bill 267, opening a work session. Senate Bill 267?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Walker?
I'll move Senate Bill 267 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker moves Senate Bill 267 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Minnis?
I'm going to support the motion. However, I do want to give some advance notice to the committee that when the bill moves to the House, my assumption is it's going to end up in this House Judiciary Committee, and I think Chair Williams and I have had some discussions with him about the bill and continue some of the discussion with the governor's office. So the heads up is it may come back looking different later on.
I think I'm in the same place you are. I'd like to see that greater issue discussed, but I also don't want to hinder the bill. So, yeah. As we used to say in the House, let them fix it in the other chamber.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
The only comment I would have as it relates to the gender of the makeup of the board, I would prefer, if it were me that were drafting the bill, that there would be language that basically would say that the makeup of the board ought to be representative of the makeup somehow of folks that are out there in the world that are working in this kind of overall area, as opposed to specifying specific folks be male or female. So this kind of to put that into the mix, if there's fixing to be done on the House side, that might be an approach to take.
I think that's a very good comment, and it's not only a gender issue. I think there's an issue of also racial representation. I mean, when you look at, especially in corrections, I would guess that would be a bigger issue than in the general population.
Yeah.
Yes, Senator Walker?
Yes, thank you. I appreciate the background information that I got on the bill because I didn't know that, and that's what comes when you haven't been around very long. Even though I've been around three terms, it seems like I'm still a newbie. So I appreciated the discussion and about how this is a board that really should be flexible with the times and change as it becomes necessary. And I think the argument was compelling about that, notwithstanding the arguments opposed. So I think we're doing the right thing.
Thank you. Ms. Gravel, would you call roll, please?
Senator Starr?
Aye.
Senator Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Minnick?
Aye.
Senator Corcoran? Aye. So Senate Bill 267 is on the way to the floor. I don't know. Does anybody have an interest in carrying this, or you want to do it? Senator Menace will carry the bill. Thank you very much. Closed hearing. Senate Bill 267. Open a work session on Senate Bill 269. And we've had this bill before us before, colleagues. It prohibits certain employees of the Office of Emergency Management from striking or recognizing a picket line. And after the public hearing, I'm not sure who was designated, Ms. Botkin, maybe someone was designated to get an amendment. So we have that amendment before us now. So who was responsible for the amendment? You guys, why don't you want to come forward then, and just for the record, put it on record what you did. I don't believe so.
Okay.
I got just two more bills here. I think this one is fine. So,
okay.
Mary Botkin, for the record, Mr. Chair, with the American Federation of State County Municipal Employees, represent folks who work at the Office of Emergency Management. We think that this definition appropriately narrows the definition of the employees who would be covered by this bill. And we're happy with the amendment as it's written.
Okay. Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Ken Murphy, and I'm the Deputy Director of Oregon Emergency Management, and Mary and I and others have worked on it, and I think we've covered everything that is equal for all of us and supported.
Okay, thank you. Any questions?
Just a motion.
Pardon me?
Just a motion.
Okay. I'll entertain a motion, Senator Menace.
Adoption of the Dash 1 amendment.
Senator Menace moves adoption of the Dash 1 amendments. Any discussion? Any objection? So moved.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Menace.
Senate Bill 269 is amended to the floor of the Senate with a two-pass recommendation.
Senator Menace moves Senate Bill 269-1, or excuse me, Senate Bill 269 is amended to the floor with a two-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, Ms. Gravel, will you call the roll, please?
Senator Scott?
Aye.
Senator Vice Chairman?
Aye.
Chair
Aye. 269 as amended goes to the floor, and I guess I'll carry it. Pretty straightforward. Even I can carry it. So straightforward. Okay. We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 271. Mr. Ellsworth, what do we have here?
Chair Corcoran, members of the committee, Senate Bill 271 delays operative date for provisions restricting authority of Department of Public Safety standards and training to accredit certain training programs, provides that department can continue to accredit training programs of Oregon Police Corps.
Thank you very much. We have Mark Landauer from the City of Portland speaking to a packed audience.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Mark Landauer with the City of Portland's Office of Government Relations. Thank you for hearing this bill today. This bill is a genesis from something that was actually mentioned previously during a previous bill that you had heard. Over the years, the City of Portland has conducted approximately three or four basic training academies for police training. One class was approximately 74 participants, but on average, these classes have been about 24 students. The primary reason the city has conducted its own academy in the past is due to capacity issues at the current facility at Monmouth. When we have had to put together large recruitment classes due to the retirement and promotions of existing officers, DPSST simply has not had the available space to absorb all the recruits in our classes. Of course, these delays were of grave concern to us, and as a result, we conducted our own training academies for these police recruits. We were able to do this because DPSST has historically had the ability to accredit basic local training programs. Last session, as mentioned previously, a bill was passed that eliminated DPSST's ability to accredit local basic training programs beginning on July 1, 2004. There were several reasons why this legislation was passed, among them the concerns about consistency of basic training throughout the state and the recognition that there would be a new facility for the state. That brings me to why this bill is before you today. Regrettably, the new training facility will not be completed in 2004. The best case scenario, as I understand it, is that the earliest date that the new facility could be up and operational is the fall of 2005. Apparently, that's a pretty rosy estimate. As a result, we are asking that our flexibility for the City of Portland be maintained to run our own basic police training program in the event that we do have significant police manpower shortages between now and the completion of the new facility. I'd mention one thing. DPSST did approach me, and you'll find this in my testimony at the end, has notified me that they would like to see a couple amendment added to the bill. On line 11 of the first page, they would like the word basic inserted between police officer basic training and the same thing on line 21. They just want the word basic inserted there as well. I have taken an amendment to legislative council. It is in the process. I don't know what the will of the committee is. We certainly could have that done over in the other side, but I understand that there are other outstanding issues that the committee may want to address with the attractive nature of the relating clause to this bill. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Mr. Chairman, just for the record here, let the committee know that Mr. Landauer is correct in terms of what his testimony is and why the bill was passed. The concept adopted last session was that all basic training would be accomplished through the new facility, and that we wouldn't have the agencies doing their own accredited law enforcement training at the basic level. And part of what I said earlier is that we really don't know where this whole training facility is going or what the governor's direction will be with respect to law enforcement training and budget. So it may very well be that the governor's direction is we're simply going to continue to compress to the state training. Then that necessitates, I think, that we back away from the idea that all people, all officers go through the training, and I think it's unfortunate because I think it creates a very patchwork approach to law enforcement training or corrections training, et cetera. So my hope is that the governor's office will, you know, in good faith, sit down with participants and try to come up with a process that will work well for everyone. So the other part of this that I don't think Mark mentioned, he did mention the police corps issue. The police corps issue was one that was not foreseen during the 2001 session. As it turns out, that this is a federally funded program, if I'm not correct. And this correct. Law, as passed, would have eliminated their ability to continue. So
I see. I guess the only question that kind of arises to me is that outside of the City of Portland and the state police,
Eugene. Multnomah County.
Oh, really? They do their own trainings as well?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And I'd just add that among some of our recruitment classes, we have taken some recruits from other jurisdictions in the Tri-County area. So some of the other jurisdictions have sent their recruits to participate in our training program.
And, Mr. Chairman, part of the discussion we had last session was that some of the agencies who were doing their own training felt that the training they were getting through the department was inferior or was not what they had expected for their particular officers. Now, in my shepherding this through last session, my admonition was is that we needed to increase the competency of the training on the state level. We don't want an inferior product. We want a quality product. So the quality product is training material for all agencies, whether you're in Burns, Oregon, or Coos Bay, or Portland, or Washington County, or wherever, for that purpose of basic training.
And Mr. Chair, certainly that was one of the concerns that the City of Portland has had in the past, and I didn't want to get into that. But what I will say now is that the City of Portland's Police Bureau and PPSST has an excellent working relationship. It really has turned 180 degrees to a large extent. One of the concerns was that we were unsatisfied with some of the training programs. We wanted, for example, self-defense classes taught by some of our members within our police bureau who were some of the best in their field. They just weren't being allowed to teach down there. Well, they are now, and we are participating fully with the training programs down in Monmouth, and we're very satisfied with what is going on. But the concern that this bill addresses is if there is a significant shortfall or capacity issue, we need to be able to address those training situations quickly because it is a public safety issue in our community.
Well, Senator Menace, I can't remember our discussion right beforehand, but does it make more sense to go ahead and get this thing moving since they're getting the amendment on basic police training? To just keep it moving, or do you want to hold on to it?
I'd actually like to hold on to it. I'm not going to belabor it too long, but I do want to have the discussion with the governor's office. And if word I get back from the governor's office is we're not going to have a discussion, then as far as I'm concerned, we'll release the bill.
Okay. Why don't you go ahead? We'll just go ahead and try to get the drafting done, and we can get that piece of it done. There's agreement on that. And we can bring it back once more for a work session just to insert the language, and then we'll hold on to it until Senator Menace has his discussion with the governor's office.
And actually, the DPSSC amendment is not inconsistent with what our earlier discussion.
Okay. Okay, with that, we'll close public hearing on Senate Bill 271, and we're adjourned. Thank you.